to Hidden Orb Specs, a podcast that used to be about Hades and now is about me talking to my friends or my wife about games when I want to do that. I am your host, Ridiculous Hat, and this week we're joined by Jorbs. Hi, Jorbs.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm taking a week off, starting 9 hours from now, which is, this is like the last thing. The last thing. And then I'm on the beach.
That sounds fantastic. I am honored to be your, I guess, actually ultimate commitment prior to the beach. I was going to say penultimate, but you got nothing left. Have you packed?
I have to put some clothes in the backpack. It'll be fine.
It's not out of concern, just out of clarity for the listener. But listener, this is Jorbs. Jorbs, this is the listeners. You'll talk to them later. So we'll be getting to know Jorbs in a little bit. But you can also get to know everyone by following our social media accounts. We're on podcast platforms. Again, this feed is dormant, but I kick it up whenever I want to talk about things, which is mostly Souls-likes and my house with my wife, but every so often I get my cool gamer buddies on the show. We have a Discord where right now we're mostly talking about Marvel Snap because we're waiting for Hades 2 to come out, but don't worry, Hades 2 is coming, and you won't be able to stop me talking about Hades 2. Not that anyone is going to try. But for now, we are here to talk about, well, different kind of video game. Very different, I think, different from anything we've covered on the show here. But first, let's get to know our guests. For those of you who don't know you, Jorbs, tell us about your, I was trying to think of how to phrase this, saga, journey, whatever you want to call it.
Where would you like me to start?
The Cliff Notes.
I can start anywhere from 4,000 years ago to, like, this morning.
So we're going to go in between those.
Okay.
Mostly,
I figured
like,
we would.
Yes, I figured you might. Let's start after, it's going to be pretty close to the last like 1% of that, if not smaller, I haven't done the math. Really just about when you started making content, whether you knew you were doing it or not, until the present moment.
I think for me, I started making content in heavy parentheses at this point, quotation marks, scare quotes. I think it was when I was posting on Magic the Gathering forums with you. I moved internationally as a 12-year-old, and so I didn't have any friends locally anymore. And I took to the internet in 1999, 2000, when it was all very new, to connect with people. It was my way to talk with my family back home and my friends back home. And also, I started getting into Magic the Gathering, talked with a bunch of people there, and I started making little videos about Magic the Gathering and walkthroughs of games I was playing. And at the time, the idea of doing that as a job kind of didn't even make sense. It was sort of something you did for fun online, but
you could get a few viewers on Justin.tv, like, I guess.
I don't think I knew that existed at the time that
most
I was
people
doing
didn't.
This. Yeah. Yeah, the entire idea of the creator economy didn't quite make sense. I assumed that I was going to go to college and get a normal job, and I tried to do that and ended up playing poker instead because I was very good at strategy games. I'd been playing Magic all this time and posting about it online, and poker was easy. And then after I found out that poker isn't very fun to play millions of hands of, which is like my opinion, but I think also a lot of other people's opinion, I left poker and ended up rediscovering all these other strategy games that I had enjoyed playing and making content for. And now Twitch.tv existed and I could, you know, actually stream them online and all the infrastructure was there for me to make a job out of it. So that's what I've been doing for the last 7 years.
7 years, man,
that's a
while. And I will tell you, I was scrolling my YouTube feed this week, as I usually do, and I saw an XCOM Long War video from you, and I was like, oh my goodness, the nostalgia factor. Because that was your, like, back when you were doing Long War the first time, I think you were Joe in Ribs. I don't know how you pronounce that version of the name.
Neither do I.
Yeah. Listeners, by the way, for those unaware, it was In Between Jorbs at the time. That was the reference. Didn't brand as well, so that's been updated.
I also have a Jorb now, so
you do.
It just makes more sense now.
It's multiple factors.
Yeah, my success as a content creator, I'd already done a lot of this sort of stuff, so I was already fairly decent at it and knew how I wanted to do it and knew what my target audience enjoyed consuming because I'd been doing this for fun for 10 years or whatever. My success as a content creator came when I volunteered for Long War 2, which was an official modding project for XCOM 2, which was actually paid for by 2K, who published the game. And I got called onto the team as a volunteer to do balance testing for the highest difficulty because they knew that I played Long War 1 because they'd seen me doing it online and making YouTube videos of it and stuff like that. So when Long War 2 officially released, this was like a big project. I was under NDA. We were working with Firaxis, getting like, we had access to all the code for XCOM 2 and everything. When Long War 2 officially released, I booted up my stream to be like, hey, check out this game. I know all about it. I can explain all the hardest strategies and the mechanics. And I even know like 2,300 bugs that haven't been fixed. So we can... And like 200 people tuned in for that. So, you know, I'd already built up a decent following from doing other stuff. And that was the hurdle that I had to jump to get to a point where I was actually like, oh, this is a career, maybe. It was the first time I was making more than minimum wage as a content creator. And yeah, went from there.
A special moment in anyone's life where they can work double the hours and get slightly above federal minimum wage. But yeah. Like, it sounds like I'm being ironic, but actually no. But actually, it's just really important and a kind of a key indicator that you can get there. And you got there. And so listeners, you probably know this if you recognize Jorb's voice. We're not going to talk a lot about Slay the Spire today. Every games Discord that I'm in has a Slay the Spire channel because it's Slay the Spire. But if you want Slay the Spire content, go to Jorb's Twitch and YouTube channels. He's got that covered. There is a good amount of it. But I didn't feel a strong need to cover that today.
My YouTube playlist for Slay the Spire runs is over 1,000 videos long.
There's a lot there. Yeah. So, but that's part of what I like about the project that we have over here is that we get to talk about the things that creators don't always have the opportunity for. However, we are going to talk about something that Jorbs would like to talk about in as many places as possible. You wrote a book.
I did write a book. I started writing an angry blog post because I found out that a team I was on, like an esports team kind of thing, or like a creator collective, hadn't paid me for 3 months. And I was pissed off, you know? So I was writing like, oh, these people suck, blah, 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 blah. Angry, no punctuation. Thinking I'd like probably delete it the next day. But instead the next day I kept writing. I like had a lot to say. And then I like looked at it at the end of day two and I had 15,000 words. I looked up how long a book is. And it's actually not that many more than 15,000 words, like 60K is a short book. And so I like talked to my manager who was also on the team and asked her if she had any perspective on all this stuff. And we started having this conversation about what it was like to be on a content creator collective as a male public facing talent type person, which is what I am, versus a female project manager, creator manager. There's a better word for what she does. Anyway,
so handler. I think of it as front of house versus back of house, right?
Sure. Yeah, but she was managing all the streamers and I was one of the streamers and I was a man and she was a woman. And when we started talking about our experience working for this team, we realized that there were a lot of things that didn't match. A lot of our understandings of who people were and whether they followed through on things and whether they were kind didn't match. And that felt worth delving into more deeply. So the book as it stands is like 75,000 words. And I think I spent over 100 hours interviewing maybe 40 different people, primarily women, because it is a book about sexism and my voice is inadequate for writing a book about sexism, so I needed to talk to as many of my friends as I could. And I think it's a pretty good book. It's very vulnerable. A lot of readers say it makes them think about empathy, think about the experience of other people in gaming, makes them try to be better people. Like, the response I've gotten for it is incredibly positive and has made me feel like it was well worth spending 2 years and $3,000 on writing this thing, because so far I have spent 2 years on this and I'm down $3,000 so far. I don't think writing a book is lucrative.
It feels like there's also a similar like on-ramp in terms of the break-even point, and the upfront effort is probably substantial, but seems like a story worth telling and a book worth reading. My copy isn't here yet, but I pre-ordered it because I don't think it's not in full public release quite yet, is it?
No. Official release is May 23rd. If you pre-order direct from the publisher, we are shipping those already. If you pre-order from like Barnes & Noble or Amazon or whatever, those will get sent out in May. Audiobook is read by Ray Chase, who is incredible. Very successful, well-known voice actor, did an incredible job with it. And ebook will be out on the 23rd as well.
That's wonderful. And this is Before We Go Live, Navigating the Abusive World of Online Entertainment. It's be prepared for it if you pick it up. It's not a light read about video games on the internet, but it is. I read that review you just posted about what you're going to tell people when they ask what your real job is.
Oh yeah.
People are feeling this. They have feelings about this, about the story.
The crowning achievement for me anytime that I create content, it's very easy for me to get someone to say, hey, thanks so much for helping me understand Slay the Spire, or thanks for explaining this XCOM game to me because I've never seen it before or something like that. And that's like a service that I provide to a lot of people, and that's sort of what people expect to get out of me. They tune into my channel expecting to learn something about Slay the Spire or whatever. But the crowning achievement for me as a content creator is when I get an email from someone, because like a chat message wouldn't let them go into an up-depth and they want it to be more personal. And they tell me about like how they tuned into my channel 4 years ago and my like disciplined and analytical approach to thinking about a game made them think about the things that they were doing in their own life. And then I often extend my analysis of like cost benefit and what have you beyond the game and say like, hey, you could think about other things in your life this way. And I'll get emails from people who are like, yeah, so I was like a server at a restaurant, but you made me really think about how I wanted to be spending my days and times, what was important to me. And now I'm coding and loving it. And I have way more money and I'm way more efficient with my time. And it's great. And for me, that's like, that is the thing that really makes me feel like I'm doing a good job. That's why my profession has value. And I have been getting so many of those messages from people who have read the book. So that has made me feel very good, for sure.
Time and money, very well spent, I think. And especially like in the world of the creator economy, it's very easy to be seen as a brand and not as a person. And it sounds like this is a real, like, personal connection that people are making here, at least to a degree.
Yeah. There's a lot to be said about the concept of parasocial relationships.
Yeah.
My current somewhat hot take is that it's not really a real thing, this idea of a parasocial relationship. I have a contractual relationship with people when they choose to watch my channel. There is some implied contract that I have with them that I'm going to provide them calm entertainment and they are going to, you know, not abuse me. And that's essentially the extent of that relationship. But I think that generally, if people start to develop a stronger relationship with me than that, it's just a normal human relationship. You can't like call it parasocial as though the emotions that are felt and the trust that is built and stuff like that is somehow different from a different relationship, in my opinion. The purpose of saying parasocial is to say that there's one of me and many other people, but on the other hand, a lot of the friends that I've made in the last 7 years are people who were on the other side of an, in quotations, parasocial relationship, and like, nope, it was just a normal relationship. Like, I just needed to make some time and energy for them, and now they're awesome friends. So yeah, one of the big achievements of the book for me is that it's a way to have that real relationship with people in a one-to-many state. I only have to write it once, and then I can have a deep conversation with the reader about all of these things which are important to me. And it's simple enough for them to respond with a 3-paragraph email saying, hey, this was really good, this spoke to me, and then say hi to me at a convention or something to talk about it some more.
Let's see. A lot of interesting things there, just about how parasocial almost describes like humanity through a different mechanism, really. Like, it's not necessarily just the way that we interact with people, just it's the scenario, right? The circumstance, the environment.
I think there's something deeply ironic in that the idea of a parasocial relationship is introduced to try to create sympathy for creators, I think. To point out, like, hey, this person is trying to cater to thousands of people. They cannot be your friend. Like, they cannot spend 30 minutes of their day having a conversation with you. This is a parasocial relationship, not a regular relationship. And so you have to act differently. I think that's kind of the reason that this idea of parasocial relationships is introduced in the world. But in creating sympathy for creators, I think it fails to attach empathy to creators, where like creators are humans and we're surrounded by other humans all the time at our jobs. And it's generally pretty nice if people treat us like human beings and think about us kindly and, you know, treat us the way that you would treat someone who was just a normal friend. And in many ways, if you're hanging out on someone's channel, chatting with them all the time, like the relationship you have with them resembles just a normal friendship. And at some level, it even can be a normal friendship. Like I said, I have lots of normal friends where they started out as people in my chat.
Yeah, I mean, when you go out to dinner with somebody, that's not parasocial. That's just a social thing, right? And so, you know, and I don't go to dinner with every person that listens to one of my podcasts, but there are times when someone's around, it's like, hey, you want to grab a beer? And like, you know what? I kind of do want to grab a beer. Let's grab a beer. And that's just social.
One of the wonderful things about my job is that I've gotten to meet many very incredible people. And, you know, I get to pretend that I'm there to hang out with them because I'm important to you, when actually I'm basically just fanboying the entire time. And something that I've noticed just about people with that level of celebrity that puts them on the para side of a parasocial relationship, I guess, is that if you just like talk to them about normal things, they're like just normal humans, which like obviously, right? But I think few people consider that. Many people are like, oh my God, I'm going to meet Jorbs. I want to talk to him about Slay the Spire and get him to sign my Jawworm plushie or whatever. Which, by the way, Casey and Anthony, Jawworm plushies won. It's just like free money. But really, like the conversations that I've had at conventions with people that I've enjoyed the most, that where they like talk to me about how they really enjoy playing piano or something like that. And it's just like, oh, this is fun. Yeah, we're talking about being humans, like normal humans.
Yeah, it's so my day job, I work in a movie theater. All right, I've worked for a movie theater company for 16 years. And one of those theaters that I worked at, we got a lot of premieres. And we told the staff, like, yo, the people that are here that are in the movie, they're kind of working, but don't go up and talk to them about their job, like about the movies they're in, even if you're a huge fan. And the way I would frame it to them is like, all right, you're on the subway home. Someone comes up to you. It's like, yo, the last time I saw you make popcorn, it sucked. Make popcorn better next time. And then you're on the train. Your headphones are on. Someone taps you on the shoulder. Oh, man, I can't believe that one time you made popcorn 10 years ago. Like, I watch it every day. It would just be weird because people are there to talk to you about your job that you're not doing for them. You're doing because it's your job. And you can frame that in really in any context. But in some, it's almost expected because, you know, you're the entertainment celebrity, like the thing that you do to entertain people, people are excited about it. They want to connect with you about it, but it's your job. Same with, you know, actors.
I think there's simultaneously a like belief of overfamiliarity and a misassignment of what is important to the person. Like if I walk up to Ewan McGregor and start talking to him about the Star Wars prequels, there's a decent chance that the experience of me watching the Star Wars prequels and the experience of him starring in them was not similar in any way. It doesn't actually create any connection with me and him at all. But for me, that's like all he is in my mind, or it might be. Actually, no, he and his wife had a pet duck in LA, so I know two things about Ewan McGregor. yeah, so it's just going to be weird for him. Like, he's just a like human dude, you know, planning a motorcycling trip to South Africa or something, and I want to talk about this movie that he was in 20 years ago.
Yeah. So, the important thing, listener, that we want you to take away from this, if you see Ewan McGregor, ask about the duck. Don't ask about Star Wars. It's a duck angle. That's the way you want to go. And also, we'll have a link to those jawworm plushies in the show notes if you want to check those out. Because I kind of want one. You don't have to autograph it, but I kind of want a jawworm plushie.
I don't think they exist. They really should.
They should do that. Yeah. But either way, so this episode, we're going to be talking about a game that is not Slay the Spire. It's kind of strategy, more like lifestyle is how I'm going to frame it. But before we talk about it, it's been fun to see you explore games that aren't, you know, your main thing on stream, your main product. And I'm wondering if there are any that really stand out to you that you would recommend to the listeners here. You know, we're originally a Hades podcast. Roguelikes are cool. And they are, you know, a pretty good genre of games to pick up and stream. Like Northern Lion has built his career on weird roguelikes. And Halion, who's been on before, is also explores that sort of thing. Trying to think of any that really stood out to you besides Orb. Against the Storm, I remember you tweeting about and being really excited about.
That was very good, yeah. I don't think Slay the Spire's that good. It's great. It's very, very good. There are many games that I've played that are better than it. And the problem is that they are not games you can play 8,000 hours of, which is how many hours of Slay the Spire I've played.
It's a lot of hours.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's hard to make a game that you can play that sort of amount of time of and have it be like a unique, interesting experience in every moment. And on the other hand, a game like Outer Wilds, which I played for 18 hours, maybe, like every second of that feels like it's etched in my mind. That game absolutely earned every minute that it was on my computer monitor.
All 22 of them.
Yeah. I have very many games that I would love to recommend to people. If you go to twitchtracker.com/jorbs/games, you can see a list of the games that I've played on my stream. And generally speaking, if I played it for more than 5 hours, I thought it was really good. And there are a lot of games there that I played for more than 5 hours. Outer Wilds, Celeste, Return of the Oberdin, Luck Be a Landlord, Grease, Sunhaven. These are the ones. These are the ones that I mention in my dating profile, because at the bottom of my dating profile, I'm like, I play a lot of games for work. Maybe if we don't meet up, at least you can get some really sweet games out of reading this.
That's, well, all right. That now there's the recommendation. If you don't love me, maybe you'll love these.
Yes. Yeah.
Shout out to Return of the Oberdin, one of my favorite games of the past ever, I think. Yeah, really, really good. But I'm going to go through this profile later. I'm not going to do it while we're live on the show, even though I am tempted by my poor impulse control. Yeah. But we're here to talk about the Orb. An Orb of Creation. I found out about this because you monster, you homewrecker, you brought this into our lives where you streamed the silly game and then 8 hours in, you were discovering brand new mechanics. We're going to try and not spoil too much, but listeners, so I'm going to start with the sales pitch here. There are going to be some spoilers just because I have to talk to somebody about this experience. But the way I've been describing it to people is like, if Crusader Kings 3 was an auto-clicker, is kind of where I'm at, just in terms of depth and complexity. What's your sales pitch?
I think it's not quite that deep. I think for me, the reason I like it, it's a very different game from most games. So I think people who like it will often have different reasons that they like it. For me, the reason I like it is it's all of the enjoyment of making numbers go up that you get out of a 4X game like Civilization or Stellaris or something like that, with enough mechanical support to feel like one of those games. Like, you sort of have many different resources and you're trying to balance them all the right way and get the most you can out of each of them. It's that without having to worry about like pressing end turn or making one wrong move and losing a city or having the AI declare war on you or late game getting really long and boring. Like, it kind of dodges every problem that those games have for me. And yeah, I've always enjoyed strategy games as resource transfer games. When I play a game like Magic the Gathering or Civilization or Orb of Creation, I'm always thinking like, okay, the game is giving me the opportunity to turn this into that. Should I do it? I'm trying to recognize all of the different ways that I can turn one thing into another and trying to work out which one's the best one to click on. This is something that I've always enjoyed doing in games. And Orb of Creation gives you so much of that. Every second that you have, you're thinking about how can I turn this moment of time into the most resources of which resources is even the important one right now. I have to work that out too. And yeah, it's constantly interesting and enjoyable. And like you said, you keep discovering new mechanics even 8 hours into the game, which is like filthy. Like, like to the point where it almost feels like it's a different game sometimes because this new mechanic that you've discovered does something completely different.
The moment that I went and bought the game, I was tuning into your stream at the end. And you were like, oh, it's a video game now. 8 hours in and it's a video yeah. game. And that's what happened. It was so goofy. Just like, we should have seen this coming, but how could you have seen this coming given the context of everything that you've seen before in the game? So it's, all right, I'm gonna break the spoiler thing now, but the way I want to describe it before I do that, this is... So in the past, when you think of Cookie Clicker, the original name for this genre was idle games. This is not idle. This is active. It is incremental, right? Over time, you develop more resources. It's like very upgrade-centric, a lot of resource management. But it is not an idle game. It is very, really, really not. It's you have to be paying attention to it. And in fact, it's almost the complete opposite. It is maximalist incremental. You are flipping between menus and buttons and changing things and tweaking things all the time, the entire time you're playing it. Very, very engaging. So I will just say, if this sounds appealing to you, we're not going to tell you everything that happens, but we're going to get excited about it. And so if you want to explore the whole thing for yourself, just pause this right here. It's audio content. It'll stick around. Go get it. Set aside 20 hours, whatever, like not all at once, but like you'll want to, and then go play. And then when you're done, come back and listen to the rest of this. Yeah, when you spend the entire game just like managing magical resources and then you're shooting fireballs at ghosts, like, okay.
It was really funny to me because a lot of the game up until that point felt like a fighting game because you have a spell bar and you're trying to work out how to build the best combos in your spell bar to make the most of the resource that you're trying to make. So you're like, oh, I use like this ability with dilation, and then I like charge this ability, and then I can channel this for 12 seconds until my mana runs out, and that will make me like a million of those.
Okay, so are we talking about the same button that was on most of my bars? Brainstorm was the nuts. Brainstorm and Amass Power are the two that I used all the time. Brainstorm is the one where it's...
Does that make scrolls and divination?
No, that's the... So, Brainstorm... Yes. Yes, that's the one. Yeah, it makes the pink and purple. You spend your sparks to make pink and purple. That's Brainstorm.
I think that's different from what I'm thinking of, but very
similar. Thinking of the one that that it makes the pink and the pink scrolls. That one was
very
good too.
Very similar idea.
It's really hard to remember. Like, there are, I don't know how many resources, I think it's low triple digits, but there are a lot of different things to keep track of. That's the whole point of the game. Like, I remember for a couple sessions, water was the limiting factor. I just could never make enough water. And then eventually my alchemy got strong. And I was like, oh, now I have literally billions of water. And I didn't know how that happened. It suddenly just had all the water in the universe.
Yeah. There are a few multipliers in late game which kind of sneak up on you. You feel like everything's kind of stressed and pushed to the limit, and because you're trying to chain things, where you'll turn one thing into another thing into another thing into another thing into another thing. Sometimes these chains get to like 5 or 6 long, passive chains, and sometimes one of your passive chains is like missing one of the resources, so you're having to actively make that resource to keep your passive chain going. But anytime you have a passive chain that's that long, if you like level up your alchemy to a point where everything's 1% more efficient, that 1% gets applied 6 times. And so I definitely found that like I was compressed on a resource, and then boom, all of a sudden I had a billion of it over and over again, which is, it's kind of exactly the opposite of Against the Storm in a way, where Against the Storm takes the idea of all this resource management, and the way it solves the problem of you eventually getting to a point where you have a billion is it says, okay, you win, like the second that you get there, or arguably before you get there even. Whereas in Orb of Creation, you get a billion of that resource, and then Orb of Creation is like, okay, cool, that resource does not matter in any way. Also, now we're playing a different game.
And then a few hours later, you'll loop around and figure out you need that resource to level up this other spell to unlock this other thing, where this resource from the first tab works with this one from the 6th tab. And then you have to do research and you run out of a region you've had too much of forever. And then suddenly all your other stuff breaks. You're like, whoa, where's this coming from? It's you end up building like not a house of cards, it's a skyscraper of cards. It's pretty rad.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's really fun. Another thing that I got out of it was it felt like a narrative experience, which is like it's so bare bones. It has a nice soundtrack. It has very minimal lore. The lore is there is an orb. You are going to use it to create. It's in the name. But as you do that, like the stuff that you build and discover creates a universe. And it does that mechanically and in terms of the lore, where like you'll build a world and then you'll put a workshop on that world. And then there are other creatures on the world and so on and so forth. And it's just kind of interesting to see what's going to happen next. So the first time through, it kind of felt like almost like a walking simulator, where it's like a narrative experience. And at that point, you don't understand which resources are most important, so you're not going to be able to maximize everything, but you're just enjoying finding out what's next. And the second time I played through it, I was like, okay, now we're going to get into the resources, because I kind of know what to expect. Let's see how quick I can do it.
What was the difference? I haven't done a second playthrough yet, because it seems like there is going to be a save wipe. I think it's a fresh start for the next version, so I'm waiting for that.
That's very exciting.
Yes, like I'm looking forward to it, but I want to know, what was your second playthrough like? How different was it?
There were too many resources for me to remember all of them, and too many, like, what are they called? Unlocks or something?
Research?
I forget what the stuff on the right is called.
Upgrades, I guess, right?
Upgrades, like
Yeah.
Some of those are really big deals, and there are also like 100 plus of them, so I definitely didn't remember exactly which one I was meant to be going for next, you know? Like, some of them are like, get 5 times as much of this resource, and like, that's a good thing to get if you need that resource, but I didn't always remember where they were. But yeah, I was able to like path through it pretty sensibly in a way that like The first time playing it, I was carried by like finding out what happens next. And then the second time playing it, I was carried by trying to synergistically carry myself through all the things that I knew were coming, which is a wonderful feeling.
Yeah, it reminds me almost of replaying a Metroidvania or something, where even though you know where the item is, the joy is in the mastery component. And this is not in the roguelike school. There's a different autoclicker I've been playing, actually, or incremental game that's in the roguelike thing where it's all about prestiging and whatever and the variability there. This is the unlocks are always going to be in the same order, but it's all about the player mastery experience of just understanding it more and getting it and then being a part of the world.
Yeah, I think very commonly a game is two games. There's what it is when you're discovering it and what it is when you know it. And in the world today where like we have more games than just chess and Monopoly, which is like what I played when I was a kid, it matters a lot what it feels like to learn a game. Like spending an hour and a half reading a rule book before you play a board game is a huge barrier to entry, which a lot of people are not interested in. And so games like Brotato and Vampire Survivors, and I would say Orb of Creation, and a lot of popular viral hit games recently have done an incredible job of just making it so there's almost no barrier to entry whatsoever. You open the game, you click play, and the mechanics are simple enough that you basically know what they all are already, and you're playing the game. But what you still have to do is learn all the rules, like all of the pieces that are in the game and stuff like that. Your first time through playing Orb of Creation, I think, feels like you're kind of reading the rule book in a way. And then after you've read the rules, you can keep playing if you want. I actually think Orb of Creation's like five different games, and then it's five other games again, or something like that. Orb of Creation is more games than any game I've played, I think.
It's nested for sure. Though, in terms of, so the way you described the structure versus the reality of, like, the structure versus the not the rules of how it's played, but the rules of how it actually, like, functions. Luck Be a Landlord, I think, is really, really good at this. Like, it is actually just literally a slot machine that it turns out has a lot of depth and choice and relevance in what you do. Reminds me a lot of that.
Something that I respect a tremendous amount about Luck Be a Landlord, and somewhat to Orb of Creation, I think, as well, is Luck Be a Landlord is a different type of game from what we're used to. So many games have like violence in them because we have this cultural understanding of what fighting is in video games that's developed over the last 30 years. And Luck Be a Landlord is like, well, I'm a slot machine. And we have a cultural understanding of what a slot machine is, which is very different from our cultural understanding of what a video game that was built out of Doom or Street Fighter or Civilization or whatever would be. And so you get to play a different game. And Luck Be a Landlord doesn't have to have violence in it. And, you know, it does because you turned your landlord into a soup, but it didn't need to. Just chooses to at the end because it's fun. I think Orb of Creation's kind of the same way, where Orb of Creation's kind of like, we know what a spreadsheet is or something like that. We know what a... I mean, Orb of Creation, so many things at once, but it doesn't come to you as that, like, oh yeah, this is your weapon, here are the enemies, you fight them, which is such a strong cultural understanding of what a game is, that you play like games that are about learning to type, which are like, this is your weapon, these are the enemies, this is how you fight them. We have so many games like that, and it's refreshing to play a game that isn't that.
Yeah, I remember the documentary that they did about the development of Hades. Supergiant had just come off of making Pyre, which was high fantasy wizard basketball. And, you know, really fascinating concept, very different, very highbrow. And in the first video, the game director Amir says, we wanted to make a game where you just shoot some guys, right? And so, like, that's so many people, that's what games is. Oh, you shoot some guys. Like, that's that's the thing. This is not that. No matter where it ends up, this is really not just shooting some guys. It's very, very, very not that. It's actually interesting to me how you lay out the discovery portion. And I like, because I have a question written down here, but I'll adapt to what you said. You spent 8,000 hours optimizing a single player game. So how refreshing is it to you to have these discovery experiences? I mean, looking at your Twitch played, you have a lot of these discovery experiences. I guess it's something that you kind of like really want to pursue now, given the nature of your day to day, right?
It's an interesting question. For me, like I said earlier, games are largely about understanding resource transfers, and games become somewhat meditative for me. When I play Slay the Spire, I'm in an element where I'm forced to think comprehensively about situations that I'm being presented. They are familiar to me, I know a lot about them, and I get to massage the neurons in my brain, which know those things, and force them to come up with complex ideas. And it feels really good. And I think that by playing Slay the Spire like that, when I want to write a book or something like that, I already understand the process of, like, how do I think hard? How do I collect a bunch of knowledge that I have about something and turn it into the result that I want? So I always have that sort of meditative, wonderful experience of games which I've mastered. But there's also this other experience which I have with Orb of Creation and other games, which I'm just learning for the first time, where it's like, what is this world like? What are the transfers that the person who made this game is going to present me with? And those are really fun because you get to see so much creativity, and you'll come into them with assumptions which are wrong. Like, I go into every Slay the Spire run with assumptions which are wrong still, because I'm never going to be perfect at the game. But my assumptions are, like, kind of static at this point. Like, I'll try something out for a year, and then I'll move on to trying something else out, because that's kind of the depth of knowledge about the game that I have. I need that much time to challenge what I already knew. Whereas with new games like Orb of Creation, I'll come in with, like, some ideas about what I'm doing, but I may have to scrap them immediately. And it's refreshing to constantly be adjusting on the fly, realizing that what you think about the world may not be right.
Well, I mean, it's Orb is, like, it's almost built on that reorientation feeling, right? Of it injects that routinely as part of the novelty. At a certain point, stops being, are they going to add something, but how will it change what I already know? Because you're almost, you expect more. I guess, I feel like at a certain point, I thought there can't possibly be more, right? And there still was. I remember there were a couple of moments where so many things just kind of, like, happened. I was like, overstimulated, need a break. And I took, like, 30 minutes or whatever and just, like, stepped away and closed the game and played something simpler. And or just sat in the couch and like stared at the wall, and then came back to it once I had, like, calmed down. The pace of novelty is kind of combined with the existing cognitive load of resource tracking. It feels like a lot.
I've been thinking a lot about ego death recently, for a variety of reasons unrelated to Orb of Creation, but. When I played Orb of Creation, something that happened to me was my ability to take in new mechanics and reorient to them actually got exhausted, which doesn't happen to me very often. I've been playing strategy games for 7 years professionally. But yeah, I learned this first mechanic, and I got to a point where I had beliefs about what the right thing to do with it was. Probably they were wrong, but I successfully constructed my beliefs. And then I got to my second mechanic, and I constructed beliefs about what the right thing to do with that was. And then I was introduced to a third mechanic, and I constructed beliefs about what was right to do with that. And I got to, like, the fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh. And eventually I got to a point where I was, like, juggling with too many balls. Like, I got to a point where I was introduced to potions, and it was like, I do not have enough brain to do the things I'm doing with the other stuff and to work out what I'm meant to do with potions right now. And so I didn't construct beliefs about what I should do. I just clicked on a button. And for me, that's like some sort of death. It's liberating and terrifying at the same time.
This game works so hard to put so many buttons in front of you that you're like,
yeah,
I can't think about it. I'm just going to do it. Just going to do it. Now that is novel. That is extremely novel.
Yeah, it was a letting go. It was a feeling of freedom. And I enjoyed it a lot.
Well, and I think that strategically this game, I do believe there's some commentary in the design to be had. It at least knows to some level that you're not going to optimize everything all that fast, because there are a lot of things that I've talked to a few people that have played it. The first 10 hours, my spell bars, they either changed one at a time or I just went and made a new one. I did not refine it. I did not organize. I'm like, can't do with this right now. I'm going to click the buttons I have. I'm just going to jump back and forth. It'll be fine. Or I'm going to build a brand new one to solve this one problem I have. And I had the same experience as you with potions where I got them and I'm like, consumable? And just didn't.
But then on top of that, Orb of Creation does this wonderful thing where, this is a very specific spoiler, warning in advance. If you don't want to hear it, just don't listen for like 30 seconds. But it gives you mana potions as the first potion you can make. And then shortly after that, it gives you research, which costs like 40 million mana, which is just way more mana than you have. And if you don't drink mana potions for it, it will take you, you know, 5 or 10 minutes to do it. So you have 5 or 10 minutes to sit there thinking, gee, this research is going really slow. Gee, I wonder if there's anything I can do about this research, which is going really slow. I need more mana. Geez. And then eventually, it's like getting out of bed after snoozing the alarm for like 30 minutes or something. You're like, okay, fine.
I felt that.
I'll click the mana potion.
And then it's like, oh, well, this is better than what I did before, which was sitting here doing nothing. This is something. Because that is something I noticed with the only time where I truly felt I was supposed to be rate limited was at the very end of the currently developed game. It's an early access. And there are some resources that just aren't built out yet. Soul in particular, at the very, very end. There's just no good way to impact the rate of it. And early access project, you get to the end where the development requirement for in-game upgrade says more dev time, please. It's like, Marple, you can have as much dev time as you need. But that's also kind of when you know time to pause. But before that, any time that I was sitting and waiting for something, I'm like, there has to be something I can do about this or come back to it later. There has to be some decision available to me. Because in a game that is so flush with decisions, overburdened with them, it can't possibly be correct to like sit here and wait for a while.
Although you can wait if you want, which is another nice thing.
It's an option.
I definitely had a moment where I realized for the first time that you can click on the resources to see all of the information about them. Like,
yeah,
how are you
15 hours
how
in.
Are they being drained and stuff like that. Right. The interface is genuinely good at facilitating you understanding what's going on and making the decisions, which is very cool. But yeah, I like finally had that moment when I had one of those resources and I was like, I cannot work out how to make any more of this. And I clicked in on it and it was like, oh, there is one thing I can do in alchemy, which will speed up making this resource. So I guess I will rework everything that I'm doing in alchemy, which at that point was like 100 things. Like, okay, this is the resource I need. Goodbye, all of that other stuff.
And there is some pretty incredible dopamine payoff when you're deep in alchemy and you're like, well, I need this resource now. And so you go get you figure out the imbue stuff is broken. The permanent upgrades is broken. And you go at the end of the chart and you have this level one ability that you've never used. And you're like level whatever, a billion. I don't know what the actual number is, but it's a lot. And then the second you turn it on, ping, level, ping, level, ping, level, and you just get to shoot all the way up the levels at the same time. If you were here for bar filling, it is all of that. You just watch it fill and like, look at my power unfold. It's amazing. It's great.
Did you see the Anish Gary quote from the World Chess Championship this morning?
I didn't.
He was talking about the position, and he's talking about the evaluation bar, which was like hovering around middle. And he said, I don't know why the bar isn't up all the way. My bar is definitely up all the way. Which is, he did not intend that sexually in any way. He's a very lovely, kind, innocent man. But oh my God, that was so funny. Anyway, yes, the bar goes up all the way and my bar's up all the way. And I intend that sexually.
Thank you for clarifying. Yes.
Yeah.
That's the feeling I get when I upgrade an imbue spell very quickly. So you had alluded to, we are theoretically close to the next version of Orb. I have looked in the Discord. Yeah, there's Marple is the solo dev. He does everything. Everything. And big announcement on the 20, well, not announcement, big preview on the 28th saying, I feel like I've been close to announcing this forever. And then, like you said, but maybe next week. So, incipient announcements is how I'll put it.
It's a good vocab word.
Thank you. I'm proud of that one. So we'll see. I think we've got a little bit more time because Marple, bless their heart, they've sent a few messages like this before over the months because being a solo dev seems very challenging to me. And a lot of the games, by the way, on your list are solo dev games, which, I kind of like that trend. I found Slipways is on your list. Love Slipways. Huge fan of that. It's a great 3X.
There's something you don't get out of a major studio in terms of unique vibe. Major studios struggle to create truly unique vibe because they're so big and they're creating games for an already established audience, often sequels of previous games. So, you know, they make really fun games, very spectacular games, but they're often kind of the same. But when you have single devs or small teams making games, you often play a game and it's just very different from everything else. And it's different comprehensively. All of the things are different in a way that all of them work together in their being different. And that's something that I really love about small teams making games.
Big fan. And you can get small teams exploring genres that have seen a lot of love and still putting their own spin on it. Like Death's Door, I think, is two people. Acid Nerve Studios. Love that game. It's a Zelda-like, I guess, but still really enjoyable. Orb single dev, Slipways on your list single dev, Nova Drift on your list single dev, and there's a whole bunch of other ones that you've played and really enjoyed that are really, really small teams that are doing their own thing. It's cool. Have you explored any other games in the incremental genre because of Orb, or was that your main foray?
Well, it depends. I played a lot of Minecraft. Is Minecraft incremental?
It's by the dictionary definition, yes. By the genre construct, I have no idea.
Sometimes when I play Orb of Creation, I feel like I'm playing Minecraft. Not in the strictest sense of the word. Have you played Cookie Clicker? No. There was a lovely game where you wake up on an island and have to harvest resources to build a bridge to go to another island, and then you harvest more resources, and that was incremental / idle, and I don't remember its name, but I enjoyed playing that for a while. For the most part, though, I haven't played a ton of really stripped down incrementals. Orb of Creation is almost a browser game. It could be a browser game, probably.
You could play it on their itch page, I think, on itch.io.
There you go.
Yeah. And I have a browser game open right now that I found because of Orb, where I was talking to Hamlet, who's been on the show before. They were originally going back to Kitten's Game, which apparently is like the Dark Souls of incrementals. But then Antimatter Dimensions is the one that I'm into right now, which Antimatter Dimensions, also a very small team. It is if Google Sheets was a roguelike. It's much heavier on the optimization and prestige mechanics, but it also kind of does the layers thing, but it is meant to be something that just is around. And there will be times where there are time walls where things take days, and other times where it's like, all right, I've optimized this now, and it's all about kind of solving progression problems. I found it to be surprisingly fascinating, so I'm using this spot to plug it.
It's cool. Game. It's a gardening game. Gardening games. Gardening games are games where stuff sort of happens on its own, and then you have to direct it the right way every now and then. And you sort of can, you can give a lot of feedback, or you can give a little bit of feedback.
Yes, it's user-defined time investment, right? User-defined time and focus investment.
Yeah.
But I found this one tends to be, when you get to a certain stage, it actually is like surprisingly, I guess active is the word, disproportionately rewards presence. Like, if you leave it running, it's fine. But when you get to the prestige sections, you flip back and forth between menus and do the things. And because you're doing things that you did before, but at now a different rate because you're stronger, like, it's almost like a fractally expanding roguelike in a way. Surprisingly engaging. I didn't expect it to be. And then I'm still in there. And there's some statistic somewhere in the menu that tells me how many days I spent on it. And I haven't looked at it yet. And I don't feel a need to. I'm just going to keep doing the thing. But any other games in particular that like that you're just generally excited about, whatever genre you want it to be, coming up in your channel, playing off stream, I don't care, just anything that's coming up that you have slated.
Well, I've been playing XCOM Long War 1.0,
Oof.
Which released 7 years ago. So
fun game.
I don't know if I'm excited about that as an upcoming game, but gosh, I am enjoying it.
That counts. That is the throwback. Like I remember watching Beagle Rush and Grimy Bunyip videos from many, many years ago. I always liked Grimy Bunyip because Beagle Rush was all about one square end turn. Grimy Bunyip was like, no, just move in and kill them. I like that one. I like that part.
Yeah,
it was probably,
that's more my vibe.
It was probably strategically suboptimal. Well, no, it was probably strategically optimal, but the execution was so much harder that I messed up more often, but it was more fun to shoot things. So, like, I just did that, whatever.
That's also my approach to XCOM at this point in my life. There was a point in my life where I couldn't let go of, like, this is the exact perfect way to play. I just couldn't get away from that. And so I optimized the fun out of XCOM for myself, almost. But nowadays, I'll be looking at a situation where I should clearly evacuate from the mission, and I'll be thinking, I didn't choose to spend, you know, a week of my life playing this game so that I could evac from the hard missions. Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
If I lose, it's fine. Which is a lot more fun.
It is. Games are meant to be fun. I like that. It's, some might call that growing up. I will just say that the last time we spoke was a decade ago. You watched me very poorly draft with some friends of ours. And in that meantime, we've both been through some ups and downs in that past decade, and now we're like, you know what? Just move forward an extra square, live your life, it'll be okay. We call that growing up. I'm gonna call that maturing.
Sure.
Why not? You wrote a book. You had written way fewer books back then.
Zero.
That's none. And now you have some.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I would recommend writing a book. So writing a book has given me tremendous respect for people who do it repeatedly for a living. Cannot imagine.
It seems challenging.
Yeah. I'm sure it's similar to any other long-term creative project.
But without external structure the same way, like a book is you and the paper. Like if you're making a movie, there are like 200 people that are going to be on the set waiting for you to tell them what to do. If you're writing a book, it's you and paper and or a computer, whatever. That seems scarier.
Yeah, it was hard. And you're also, you are the only person crafting the story to some extent. You're giving more of yourself to a book than to any other creative project I've ever worked on. I had two panic attacks writing my book, and then I turned one of them into a chapter.
Well, all right.
I managed to structure it, though. I you know, had interviews with people, and then I thought about how to incorporate those interviews into the passages I was writing. I had editors who pointed me the right way. I had a publisher who gave me deadlines. I reached out to my friend who records audiobooks and had him pledge to do it in 2023 so that I had a, you know, timeline to get this awesome person to do the audiobook. Gave me an artificial deadline as well. Yeah, I managed to do it. Definitely something that you have to want to do, I think, writing a book.
I feel like the general rule, there are some really hard things in life. Generally, the way to go about knowing if you want to do it is if a bunch of people tell you not to do it and then you want to do it anyways, then go ahead. And that's where I feel like when you say, I wouldn't recommend writing a book, the people that were on the fence are already not going to get that book done. Anyone that's like, no, I'm going to do it anyway, I would look forward to your story when it's out, if that's you. If I'm calling you out right now on the air, I look forward to reading your book. But I think we're going to wind down here. So, Jorps, thanks so much for coming on. Where can we find you if we want to chat in a way that is not parasocial, but perhaps maybe contractual?
If you want a contractual relationship with me, I'm at twitch.tv/Jorps. Also, I do own Jorps.tv, and when the servers are functioning, you can find everything there. But sometimes I forget to pay for it or refresh things when they change. So, you know, it's a bit of a crapshoot. If you want to just chat with me like I'm a human being, I'm in the Discord at discord.gg/Jorps. I think that's the URL. I'm on Twitter. You can treat finding me on Twitter as an alternate reality game and, yeah, you know, make a puzzle out of it if you want. It's not very hard.
No, I feel confident that you will be tagged by the show when I tweet out that this episode is out. So that's going to be...
That'll make it easier.
Fairly straightforward arc. But listener, please stay followed to the show. Even if you want to do the mystery, just open in incognito mode. It's please stay followed. Yeah, well, thank you so much for coming on. Before we go live, my Stephen Slaval over. There's a link in the show notes to the Amazon. I gotta get that direct publisher link. I didn't realize they were shipping already. I ordered from a big box store like a doof.
Oh, it's fine. They see that you ordered, and then they think that they should buy a bunch of copies. So, I appreciate it.
Cool. Yeah. Well, then I'm proud of myself. And listener, you can follow us at Hidden Aspects on Twitter, subscribe in your podcast client, join the Discord, and we'll see you in the orbit.